Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Huey's Over Quezon, Missions with VMO-6, by Peter Green. Narrated by Joe Barrett. Preface. In January 1966, like millions of young men graduating from high school, we were facing a difficult fate, the Vietnam War and the draft. With rare exception, unless you were enrolled in college as a full-time student, or had already started a family, or were classified as 4F, most likely you were going into the U.S. military. I decided to enlist in the Marine Corps, and to this day, I am proud of that fact, and that I served in Marine Aviation and VMO-6 for 13 months in Vietnam. I am proud of the service I performed, and the fact that I've been able to write about my experiences I had with the USMC Helicopter Gunship Squadron, VMO-6. I believe that I can speak for the other crew chiefs and squadron mates who shared the role of the gunner, and hope that I am not stepping on anyone's toes. I am writing this book about my own experiences and events that I have had and have seen during my tour. I know that each and every one of the pilots and other crew chiefs has had their own unique experiences, events, and shit sandwiches, which only they can recount in detail. Hopefully the day will come when I can get this published, and no doubt some of the other guys or crew chiefs will remember and recognize some of these missions as they could have been the lead or the chase bird on any given day. With rare exceptions, I do not remember who the pilot or crew might have been on a given day, but they will all agree that every day each of us had numerous missions, and rarely did we return to base without needing to rearm the birds. I hope that after more than 50 years, I can accurately describe some of the events I witnessed and was involved with during my tour. Though they took place over a half century ago, many seem like yesterday, permanently planted in my head. I can only wish that I had finished this several months ago, as I would have liked to have acknowledged and complimented all three of our commanding officers, Lieutenant Colonels Maloney, Nelson, and White, before time took them away. Chapter 1. My Background. I was born in Holton, Maine, in 1945. My father, Arthur F. Green, was a soldier stationed there at the U.S. Army base on the U.S.-Canadian border at the end of World War II. It was there that he met and married my mother, Barbara Hare, who lived nearby at Monticello, Maine. Other than farming potatoes or working in the woods, there was not a lot of opportunity for a young family in northern Maine. Soon after the war, while I was just a toddler, my mother and father moved to the northern Kentucky area, across the Ohio River from Cincinnati, where my father found work. They settled in Dayton, Kentucky, on the other side of the river. This is where I grew up and lived until Vietnam called. I was the oldest of eight children. The first six of us were boys. My parents divorced after the first four boys when I was about 7 years old, and my mother remarried a year later to my stepfather, John Torrey. They had four more children, and they are my stepbrothers and sisters. My full brothers are Richard, Timothy, and Kim Green. My stepfamily is John, Mark, Kathy, and Melissa Torrey. I attended a couple of area schools as a youngster. Then soon after my mother remarried my stepfather, John, we converted to the Catholic religion, and I attended St. Bernard's Middle School in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. I am still a Catholic to this day. Afterward, I attended and graduated from Dayton High School in 1963. Coming from a large family, my brother Richard and I started working after middle school, stocking shelves at local grocery stores to help support the family. After high school, my first real job was working for Wiedemann Brewery in Newport, Kentucky. I worked in the office of the shipping department. I was only an average student in high school, but my favorite subject was accounting. And after I started working at Wiedemann, I enrolled in accounting classes at the University of Cincinnati, attending late afternoon and evening classes. My desire was to get an associate degree and then go on to become a CPA. During high school and afterward, I started chumming around with one of my best friends to this day, Tom Ahrens. Tom attended Newport Catholic High School. He then introduced me to some of his friends who went to school there. Before long, we had formed a bond and started hanging out together all the time, and we called ourselves the TRG, Thunder Road Gang. Bill Vonderhaar, Bill Twee Hughes, Rick Vollmer, Roy Voorhees, Mike Fife, Tom, and myself. After a while, several more of their friends joined us, John Becker, Steve Saner, and Ken Heilberg. There was nothing bad, mischievous, or arrogant about us. We were just cool, and none of us got in trouble with the law, though I was lucky several times with the way I drove my car. Every time I hear the Beach Boys song, I Get Around, with the lyric, "The bad guys know us and they leave us alone," I think of TRG. Then there were the girls that we used to hang out with. Darlene, Judy, Sue, Barbara, Kathy, and others. After a while, they started calling themselves the TRGettes. Those were certainly very fond memories for me. Getting back to my first real job at Wiedemann, I really liked working there for several reasons. It was a great place to work. The company paid for my college tuition at UC, if I maintained a C average, which I managed to do, and lastly, free beer. Even though I was only 18, and the drinking age in Kentucky was 21, nobody ever said anything. Occasionally, I would have ice-cold beer. Every office had a refrigerator full of beer, and for the workforce out in the bottling plant and elsewhere, there was the tap room. It was staffed with full-time bartenders, and each employee got a 5-minute beer break every couple of hours. Kentucky was mostly hot and humid in the summer, even more so for those working in the bottling plant area. Everything was on the up and up if the employees behaved themselves and did not get intoxicated. The other cool thing for me was on Friday and Saturday nights, before the TRG headed out looking for girls. I would bring the guys down to the tap room for a couple of beers. Nobody ever objected. In addition, during my second summer at Wiedemann, after work on Fridays, I would often buy 2-quarter barrels of beer for the beach parties that we would throw on the weekends on the banks of the Ohio River. I would have bought a half barrel, but I couldn't lift one into the trunk of my car. Another plus, I was buying beer at wholesale prices. Fortunately, I was very lucky. We never got into trouble with the law, but still, being underage, I could have got not only myself but Wiedemann in big trouble. Finally, I came to my senses and stopped buying beer at my place of employment. Back in those days, we never had any trouble buying a case of beer at the local stores and bars anyway. That's just the way it was back in the 60s. I never fully realized it while goofing off in those days and before Vietnam became the big issue, but the area we frequented in and around Newport, Kentucky, was nationally known as Sin City, USA. Apparently, there was a lot of organized crime in Newport, run by the local mafia, but we, or I, just didn't realize it. There were a couple of times while out with the guys having a beer or two when John Becker and I would race our cars, his 54 Chevy and my 55 Ford, and it is truly a wonder that I am still alive today because of my stupidity. The one event that I will never forget was when somebody dared us to race. I had Rick Vollmer with me. John had someone else with him. The road coming from Fort Thomas into Newport was somewhat downhill, and at the bottom it turned, first right, then left. Both cars were nose to nose, with neither one of us willing to give up the race, with trouble just ahead. At the first turn to the right, I felt the passenger side wheels start to lift. What stupidity! Thank God we both hit the brakes and avoided rolling the cars over. For sure, I certainly was no saint in my younger days, but sometimes idiocy cannot be ruled out when you're young and you've consumed several beers and feel like you can do anything. In November 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and suddenly the world we knew was beginning to change. Most of us had never even heard of Vietnam, but shortly after Kennedy's death, the reality of the coming war and the draft became the paramount issue that held everyone's attention, especially young guys right out of high school. During that time, and back to our Thunder Road Gang days, there would always be several of us on weekends out riding around, looking for girls and having fun. But one thing that I will always remember is Bill Vonderhaar's reaction whenever we would drive by a billboard advertising the Marine Corps. He had already developed the esprit de corps, and his goal even then was the USMC and becoming a Marine officer. I believe he was the first of us to know what he wanted in life. He was soon to be leaving for the University of Kentucky to get his degree and the first step toward getting his commission. With Vietnam in the picture, it was obvious that I was not going to be able to stay in school, as I had to carry at least 15 credit hours to be considered full-time and thus defer the draft. During my second year at Cincinnati, I started advanced accounting and added business administration and was hoping to get close to an associate degree, then later become a certified public accountant. But that was not going to happen. I did not want to be drafted and decided to enlist in the USMC. My friend John Beckert likewise decided on the Marine Corps. John and I had become more excited about joining the USMC, so we decided that we would enlist together on the buddy system. I knew that John was mechanically inclined, was very good at working on an automobile, and that he did all the repairs on his Chevrolet. As for me, I really didn't have any skills. I am proud of the fact that all five of my brothers and I served in the U.S. military. My brother Richard, Dick, was the first to enlist into the U.S. Navy. Tim enlisted in the Marines immediately after I rotated home and was sent to Nam, stationed at Da Nang. Kim joined the Marines a year and a half after Tim, and he became a crew chief on the Harrier jet. John enlisted for two tours in the Navy and served aboard an aircraft carrier, while Mark opted for the U.S. Air Force and was stationed in Alaska. And I would add that my wife Kathy and I had two daughters, Amanda and Pamela. Pamela decided to enlist into the Marine Corps immediately after high school. I swear I had nothing to do with it. And today she is Lieutenant Colonel Pamela Unger and is the financial comptroller at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. A year after enlisting, Pam married another Marine. Both were in the enlisted ranks at the time, but went on to become officers. Pam's husband, Mark, Major Mark Unger, USMC retired, was initially a CH-46 helicopter pilot, then a V-22 Osprey pilot, and a V-22 instructor when he retired. And another family member I am proud to acknowledge, and who also enlisted in the USMC, Amanda's daughter and my granddaughter, Elizabeth Libby Gallant. However, Libby injured her hip in boot camp, and then after 2 years of attempted rehabilitation, was medically discharged. During that time, Libby met and married another Marine, her husband Jorge Hernandez, while they were stationed in Okinawa. In these last paragraphs, it sounds like I am bragging about all the Marines in my immediate family, and I suppose that I am, but I can assure you I had absolutely nothing to do with any of them enlisting into the USMC. It was entirely their choice. My only explanation is that they were all probably trying to outdo the old jarhead of the family, and probably they have. Chapter 2. Enlistment and USMC Boot Camp. In January 1966, I was working at Wiedemann Brewery and attending night classes at the University of Cincinnati. I knew that the draft was catching up with me. I was hoping to finish the semester and get the credits, but I did not want to get drafted into the Army. So John and I visited the USMC recruiting station, and we explained our thoughts to the recruiter. It was then that the recruiter suggested that he could make that happen if we opted for marine aviation. I'm sure neither of us had much of an idea exactly what marine aviation was, but it made sense, so both John and I were sworn in January and scheduled to start boot camp in early March 66, and I received my credits for the semester. After the semester ended, I got a letter from my mother's grandparents in Maine, Granny and Papa Porter. They were in their 80s and concerned about me going into the Marine Corps and Vietnam. Our fondest childhood memories are when the family would pile into the car and drive nonstop to Maine for a week or so to visit my mother's family in Monticello. My brothers Dick, Tim, and I were middle school age during those summer trips, and we loved to play in Papa's barn, where he made three swings for us. We would bring in and stack the firewood that he had delivered, Then he gave us each a dollar. Several mornings during our visit, he would make pancakes for breakfast on their wood stove. I'll always remember him half laughing and half exasperated, trying to keep up with three hungry mouths to feed. He used to call Graham the old woman when she wasn't around, and we weren't allowed to go in her parlor because we'd get it dirty. Those were very happy days. I'll never forget at the end of one of those trips, we had loaded up the car, we were leaving and heading back to Kentucky, and there was Papa, standing by the car with tears running down his cheeks. 2 weeks before heading off for boot camp, I flew to Maine to visit my grandparents and Aunt Chavala again. I'm so glad I did, as Papa passed away a year and a half later while I was in Nam. March arrived, and there were seven of us Marine recruits leaving for boot camp. Just before we flew out of Cincinnati Airport, which is in Covington, Kentucky, late that afternoon for that first night and the start of boot camp, the recruiter handed me a very large manila envelope. For whatever reason, they picked yours truly to carry the records and orders for all seven of us. I remember the last thing the recruiter said to me that afternoon before we boarded the plane for San Diego. Do not let this package out of your sight. There will be a Marine there to pick you guys up. When our flight departed Cincinnati Airport, we first flew to Chicago and then on to San Diego. I really didn't notice at the time, but at O'Hare, a bunch of guys our age also boarded the flight. When the plane landed in San Diego at about 11 p.m., and as we entered the terminal, there were Marines and Navy everywhere, coming and going. After a few minutes, I was getting nervous about carrying all the paperwork for the seven of us, and I started asking, "Are you here to pick us up?" Finally, I asked the right Marine, and he immediately punched me in the stomach, knocking the wind out of me. I was on the terminal floor gasping for air, trying to get my breath back, with this Marine standing over me and screaming, "Don't you ever call me a fucking you again, you fucking scumbag, is that clear?" I will never forget it. As it turned out, with the other guys on the flight out of Chicago, there were 85 of us, all recruits on the same plane, and it turned out to be our platoon at boot camp, platoon number 178. There is no need to explain anything about USMC boot camp. It was notoriously tough. Ask any Marine and they'll tell you that once was enough. I know of no one who wants to do it again. But times have certainly changed since the six Marine recruits who died at Parris Island. For decades now, it's been illegal for drill instructors, DIs, to physically hit anyone. But that was not the case in the 1960s. I found that out at the airport. But there were others in the platoon who later would learn it for themselves. That first night at boot camp seemed unreal. In a flash, we were on the bus getting screamed at by three drill instructors. Then after a very short ride, and before we knew it, we were all standing on those famous yellow footprints that every Marine remembers. It was almost midnight when we arrived at USMC Recruit Depot, and if you can believe, in the next 4 hours, our heads had been shaved bald, we were all stripped down naked, shipped all our clothes home, and all 85 of us were in the shower room for perhaps 10 minutes, all the while with DIs screaming at us. Standing in a line buck naked, we were issued a footlocker, sidestepping in a line holding the footlockers while other Marines were screaming at each one of us what size shirt, waist and leg size, what size boot, every little thing that we would need to get started. About 3 hours later, marching in the dark, we arrived at our new home, the Quonset Huts. They lined us up and assigned us to the Quonset Huts, which had about 10 bunk beds, 5 on each side. There were sheets, a pillow, and a blanket on each bunk, and in very short order, the DI showed us how to correctly make our beds. Finally, it was time to hit the rack. However, it was perhaps 15 minutes after they yelled lights out, when suddenly, at exactly 4:30 a.m., reveille sounded, and the DIs came busting through the door, screaming at us, "Outside! Out fucking side! Every one of you fucking swinging dicks outside in formation in 5 minutes!" Welcome to the Marine Corps. It was unbelievable how fast they ran us through that procedure. I won't bore you any further with other stuff that we went through, but USMC boot camp is everything that you have heard about, and once was enough. One thing that I can tell you about boot camp, at least in platoon number 178, the word fuck was very much part of the DI boot camp vocabulary. It was used numerous times in every sentence spoken by the DIs. I can't tell you how many times we heard, "You are going to be lean, mean, foul-mouthed fucking Marines, if and when you fucking make it out of here." However, in defense of the USMC, I will add here that contrary to the boot camp environment at platoon number 178's younger and junior drill instructors with their colorful and descriptive language, that was not necessarily the case afterward. Turning boys and young men into Marines in just 3 months had its challenges. In fact, it was very remarkable. Most of us, but not all, somewhat cleaned up our everyday language when we graduated from boot camp and into the regular Marine Corps, and then re-entered normal society. I'll never forget how in such a short period of time, in 3 months, those DIs transformed us from a fucking herd of cattle into a seasoned platoon as we were getting close to graduation. There were dozens of platoons in various stages of training in boot camp, and several times while we were marching, or trying to march as a Marine platoon, the lead drill instructor would happen to notice a seasoned platoon heading in our direction, a platoon that was getting close to graduation. "You fucking bunch of shitbirds, get the fuck off the fucking street, bow your fucking heads. Here come some real fucking Marines." It certainly was impressive watching them march by, the whole platoon of 85 to 90 seasoned recruits, soon to graduate from boot camp. All you could hear was just one heel hitting the deck as they marched by in perfect unison. Their utility uniforms and soft covers, hats, were starched and pressed. They were totally squared away. They looked every bit of the word sharp, and they knew it. I couldn't wait for my turn to be just like them. The platoon was divided into four squads. John and I ended up in different squads, different Quonset huts, and really didn't get to see each other very much. But it didn't matter. There was absolutely no time for socializing anyway. We were always on the run and on the go. Even at chow at the mess hall, the whole platoon was in and out in about 20 minutes. Then it was off for the next class or event. But I think I can speak for most recruits who went through Marine boot camp when I say our biggest fear was getting hurt, either on the obstacle course, in hand-to-hand combat, or any number of ways while in training. If you got hurt or injured to the point that you could not immediately continue, they would send you to casualty platoon to recover, and then you would have to start boot camp all over in a new platoon. Midway through boot camp, we were bussed up to Camp Pendleton to train on the rifle range. We were there for 2 weeks, learning to shoot the M1 rifle, and the Marine Corps prides itself on producing excellent riflemen. The first week at the range was snapping in, using the rifle sling and twisting it around your arm and elbow to hold the rifle steady. The first couple of days of snapping in were painful until you got used to it. In the second week, we started live firing at 200, 300, and 500 yards. However, at midweek, there was too much wind for live fire, so they took us on another of those many long runs. Later that afternoon, they split us up to do various work details in and around the administration building, and John and I happened to be in the same group, cleaning and polishing the floors inside the building. There happened to be a radio playing inside one of the offices. It was the first time any of us had heard a radio and any music since before the start of boot camp. After a few minutes, the Beach Boys' new song, Sloop John B., started playing. As we listened to the lyrics, "This is the worst trip I've ever been on," and "Let me go home," those words were so coincidental and fitting to our situation, we immediately both realized that it was a perfect fit for John B. Becker. He would soon be known as Sloop John B. for the rest of his days. We didn't realize it back then, but when John and I enlisted in the USMC in January to start boot camp in March, Steve Sainer had received his draft notice. The day he reported to the draft board was the first time that the USMC had resorted to the draft for recruits. When Steve reported, there was a Marine recruiter there also, looking for a few good men. Steve also decided to enlist in the USMC. Little did we know, but Steve had already been sworn in and had started boot camp 2 months earlier than John and me. As it turned out, we were all at USMC Recruit Training Depot in San Diego at the same time, but didn't know it. Steve was in the final phases of boot camp when John and I had just started, and more than likely he was in one of those seasoned platoons getting ready to graduate that we saw that day when our DI told us to get off the fucking street and watch the real Marines march by. Steve was given an 0311 MOS, infantry. After boot camp and infantry training, he was given leave and then immediately ordered on to Westpac, Vietnam. He would start his 13-month tour in Nam in June 1966, as John and I were graduating from boot camp. After graduating from boot camp and then ITR, Infantry Training Regiment, at Camp Pendleton, John and I were given 20 days of leave and then ordered to report to Memphis Naval Air Station, MNAS, for aviation training. It was part of the contract we signed to delay the start of boot camp and train for an aviation MOS, military occupational specialty. When we arrived at Memphis, we started what was called Zero Week, a week of aptitude tests where all students were given a chance to select their choice of five desired MOSs. But in the end, it really didn't matter what you wanted or which MOS you chose. It was what the USMC needed at that time. In the end, we each got what the other had wanted. I immediately started jet engine training, and John landed in avionics. Jet engine school started that coming Monday, while John's school started several weeks afterward. After arriving in Memphis and during any free time, I headed for the basketball courts, my favorite pastime. The base had a large hangar with three full-length courts with pickup games going on all the time, even in the middle of summer. After a couple of weeks of playing round ball, I was approached by one of the other guys who had been a regular playing there, and he asked me if I wanted to play for the base team. Of course I said yes. Little did I know, but he turned out to be the Naval Air Station's executive officer and the Naval Base's team basketball coach. And as it happened, there were only two students on the team, me and a Navy student, a 6'3" black kid, Hines, who was very good. Everyone else on the team, except for one, were Navy regulars. The other was a 6'8" black Marine, and they all were assigned to special services. Primarily, they'd played basketball for the Navy. As students, our classes started at 8 a.m. and ended at 4:30 p.m. Frequently, Sloop John B. and I were able to get together at the E Club afterward, and then on weekends we would go into the city on Liberty, rent a motel room, drink beer, and look for the local females. But when basketball season started in mid-October, we didn't get to socialize nearly as much. I enjoyed Memphis and the Naval Air Station, and it was great playing on the base team. But the Marine heavies did not like me playing on the Navy team, and I had zero duty, which meant that they could not assign me any duty every fourth night, and they didn't like it. One of the most memorable events that took place while at Memphis was the annual field day each November with the Navy versus Marines competing against each other in track and field competition. The Memphis Naval Air Station was the home of several Navy air squadrons and the various aviation-related schools. Obviously, it had a much larger naval personnel population, with probably only several hundred Marines, who were primarily aviation students. But the Navy made a big deal of it as an annual event. All base personnel and students, along with the numerous Navy air squadrons, were required to attend the field day and in winter dress uniform. The air base had a large college-size oval stadium, which was completely full. We Marines were seated together on the opposite side from the announcers, VIPs, and naval officers at midfield. I sat with John and several of his friends. While everyone was waiting for the dignitaries and general officers to be seated, there was a Marine with the USMC mascot, a bulldog, in front of us on the sideline. The Marine handler was standing at parade rest, holding the leash, while the bulldog was just sitting patiently at ease next to him. After a few minutes, a sailor with the Navy's mascot, a goat, came out from under the stadium seats on the other side of the field. And as they came out onto the field, the goat was fired up, trying to headbutt anyone and everyone he could get close to, while the bulldog just sat there at the edge of the field in front of us. Seeing how feisty the goat was, It wasn't long before many of the Navy squids started screaming, "Get the dog! Get the dog!" We Marines just sat there in silence, not knowing what to expect. That goat was very aggressive, and
sample complete. Ready to continue?